There is no spoon. It's such a great scene. Well, good morning. If you're new with us, my name's Tim Deal. I'm one of the pastors here. And that was, of course, a scene from The Matrix. And in this scene, you know, Keanu Reeves' character Neo comes into this room, and he's early on in trying to wrap his head around what exactly is happening as he's coming to grips with this new reality. And in this room are all of these kids who seem like prodigies. They can do remarkable things, like bend spoons with their mind. And then in this interaction, you kind of get the secret, right? That it's not that somehow this kid is able to cause matter to bend with his mind. It's that he realizes the truth, that the spoon really isn't there. And it's that truth that enables them to do things that seem remarkable, understanding what's real. Because what we believe about what's true really matters. Now, it's interesting because our relationship with truth can sometimes be a little tenuous. For example, I was reading this article produced by Business Insider a number of years ago, and they were talking about 11 crazy things that we used to believe were true. And I picked a couple of them to point out just so we could all collectively enjoy our previous ignorance. And if any of this is new to you, well, you're welcome. So one of them is that back in the late 19th century, early 20th century, we used to believe that radioactive drinks were good for you. So if something had radiation that we could, you know, kind of, we could tell, we could test and see there's radioactive elements in this, we actually thought that was a good thing. And so we would bottle that and sell it, and people would buy it and drink it. Sure, that went well. Second, there was a period of time, again, kind of towards the end of the 19th century, early 20th century, when Bayer produced a cough syrup with a really effective ingredient for battling the common cold. It was heroin. After a few years, we realized, the trade-off's not so great, and so they stopped doing that. Three, you might be familiar with this one. This is a little bit more popular lore. You see the picture in the bottom left with George Washington and on his deathbed. You might be familiar with this from history class, but bloodletting was kind of a thing, where we believed that if someone was sick, how we would cure them, the sickness was in their blood, and so the way we would cure them, we would remove blood from them. Quite a bit. We would take a significant amount of blood from someone in an attempt to cure them, which didn't always have that effect. Four, lobotomies. Now, hopefully you're not real familiar with lobotomies. These are a little bit closer to our present day. 1950s, 60s, we began to realize this was probably a bad thing. But someone discovered that if you inserted an ice pick into someone's brain through their eye, sorry, that's really, it's rough, and if you messed around with their brain, you could actually erase some neural pathways that might affect their cognitive ability. Duh, right? And so they did that for a while for people who had mental illness as a way to cure them. Again, you probably have heard stories about how that went. We stopped doing that a couple of decades ago. And then finally, again, there's a whole list of these, but for a long time, one of the cures they used for alcoholism, LSD. Yeah, and it was actually fairly effective for treating alcoholism. There were other residual effects to being cured from alcoholism with LSD, but hey, I mean, you know, pick your poison, right? So these were some things that, for years and years, these were just things that we believed to be helpful. And so people would use them. They would engage in these kinds of activities. And the result was often not great. Actually just kind of counteractive, like counterproductive. You do something to help you get better, and it actually has some destructive impact on your life. But we didn't know. We thought it was true that radioactive water would be good for you. We thought that it was true that sticking an ice pick in your eye cavity would be a helpful way to take care of mental illness. We thought it was true. And so we acted on that. Well, we are continuing our series that we're calling Look Closer, where we are looking at some of these stories, these parables that Jesus would tell. Now, parables were just simple stories that had profound meanings. But they were invitations, really, to kind of do some work on the part of the listener. You could hear this story and just kind of, okay, and walk away. Or you could dig a little deeper. You could look a little closer and discover that there's something more for you there. And so we're taking five or six of these stories throughout the next couple of weeks, and we're looking at them and asking, what might these stories tell us about Jesus, about the kingdom, and about ourselves? This week, we're looking at one out of Matthew's Gospel, the first biography of Jesus that we come to in the New Testament. In chapter 25, there's a series of texts on judgment. And there's three of them, and this one kind of falls right in the middle of them. So we're going to dive in and look at this. It's a bit of a longer story, but it's a story, so I think it'll read pretty well. If you have a Bible with you, I encourage you to turn to Matthew 25. Again, that's the first biography of Jesus you find in the New Testament. If you don't, we're going to have the passage up here on the screen so you can follow along. We're going to begin in verse 14. Jesus says, "Again, the kingdom of heaven can be illustrated by the story of a man going on a long trip. He called together his servants and entrusted his money to them while he was gone. He gave five bags of silver to one, two bags of silver to another, and one bag of silver to the last, dividing it in proportion to their abilities. He then left on his trip. The servant who received the five bags of silver began to invest the money and earn five more. The servant with two bags of silver also went to work and earned two more. But the servant who received the one bag of silver dug a hole in the ground and hid the master's money. After a long time, their master returned from his trip and called them to give an account of how they had used his money. The servant to whom he had entrusted the five bags of silver came forward with five more and said, 'Master, you gave me five bags of silver to invest, and I have earned five more.' The master was full of praise. 'Well done, my good and faithful servant. You have been faithful in handling this small amount. So now I will give you many more responsibilities. Let's celebrate together.' The servant who had received the two bags of silver came forward and said, 'Master, you gave me two bags of silver to invest, and I have earned two more.' The master said, 'Well done, my good and faithful servant. You have been faithful in handling this small amount, so now I will give you many more responsibilities. Let's celebrate together.' Then the servant with the one bag of silver came and said, 'Master, I knew you were a harsh man, harvesting crops you didn't plant and gathering crops you didn't cultivate. I was afraid I would lose your money, so I hid it in the earth. Look, here is your money back.' But the master replied, 'You wicked and lazy servant. If you knew I harvested crops I didn't plant and gathered crops I didn't cultivate, why didn't you deposit my money in the bank? At least I could have gotten some interest on it.' Then he ordered, 'Take the money from this servant and give it to the one with 10 bags of silver. To those who use well what they are given, even more will be given, and they will have an abundance. But from those who do nothing, even what little they have will be taken away. Now throw this useless servant into outer darkness, where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth.'" Not exactly a happy ending. All right, so let's break down a little bit of what we see in this story. So Jesus starts out by saying, "The kingdom of heaven is like." And this is a theme we see again and again when Jesus tells these parables, when he tells these stories. They are generally explanations of what the kingdom of heaven is like. So what's the kingdom of heaven? That's probably helpful. Often when we think about the kingdom of heaven, we think in terms of some place after we die that we go. And that's included in the definition, but that's not exclusively what Jesus is talking about. Part of how we know this is that when Jesus first arrived on the scene and started talking about what he was doing, he said, "The kingdom of heaven is at hand. It's here. It's now." The kingdom of heaven is basically where Jesus is recognized as king. Now, we don't often think in terms of king or queen because we just don't function in that world here. But basically, anywhere where Jesus is the one who we submit to, who we listen to, who gets to call the shots, that's the kingdom. Life in that realm is the kingdom of heaven. And so Jesus is saying, this is what it's like. This is what life is like now and forever for people who live in relationship with the Father through me. So he's giving us a window into what that is as he tells this parable. Secondly, this parable is sometimes called the parable of the talents. For that reason, it's often kind of been assumed that, well, this is simply about using skills that you have and how we do that. And there's something to be learned about that as we look at the passage, but I don't think that's entirely what's happening here. The reason it's called the parable of the talents is, depending on what version of the Bible you use, that word talents is actually a unit of measure for money. So in this, we read that the master gave bags of silver. Well, one bag of silver is, the unit of measure is a talent. That's what it was called. So he gave 5 talents of silver to one, 2 talents of silver to another, and 1 talent to the third. Now, a talent of silver wasn't a little bit of money. It was a lot of money. 1 talent equaled 1 bag of silver, which equaled 1,000 denarii. Now, a denarii was about 1 day's wage for a person. So if you imagine, oh, I'm sorry, I said 1,000, 10,000 denarii. So 10,000 days' wages is 1 bag of silver. So this is not a little bit of money. Even for the servant who gets 1 bag, that's a significant chunk of change that each of these individuals is given. So this is a wealthy master who leaves quite a bit of loot with his servants as he leaves on a journey. And then he comes back. And what happens? Well, for the first two, it's almost repetitive. Other than the numbers being a little different, the exact same thing happens, right? So the guy with 5, he goes out, he invests it, and he gets 10. Guy with 2 goes out and invests it, he gets 4. And how does the master respond? He's enthusiastic, excited. What a great job you've done. Come and celebrate with me. Right? Like, there's no expectation that the guy with 2 should have gotten a return of 5. He got a return of 2, and that was great. It didn't really even seem like it was tied to how much they got as much as their willingness to take this thing they had and invest it, to take a risk with the resources. There was something about their choice to live, to know that the master would want them to actually try something with what they'd have been given. Sure, there's a risk of investing, but, you know, who knows? Maybe it'll come back double, and it does. And they celebrate together. But then there's the third guy, and he digs a hole and buries it. Now, that seems weird to us because we don't often take money and put it in holes. But that was actually a fairly common practice for people during this time. It was a common way to save things. You didn't have banks in the same way. And so if you wanted to protect something from a robber, burying it in the ground was a reasonable way to do it. In fact, one of Jesus' contemporaries, a rabbi, is quoted as saying, "Money can only be guarded by placing it in the earth." It was just kind of this common thing that people did. Maybe not that different than sticking money in mattresses or kind of putting it somewhere in your home rather than putting it in the bank. So this is what this guy did. But contrast then the response, the interaction that this individual has, this servant has with his master. Whereas the first two, they get, "Well done, good and faithful servant." This one, what's interesting is you don't even get to hear the master's response. You hear the servant's accusation toward the master. What do you get, right? So he gets to the first two. "Oh, this is what we did, this is what we got, this is what we did, this is what we got." He's, "Well done." You get to the third guy, and he's like, "You know what? I knew you were a harsh man, harvesting crops you didn't plant, gathering crops you didn't cultivate. I was afraid I would lose your money, so I hid it in the earth. Look, here's your money back." The very first thing we hear from this servant is not, "Here's what happened." It's, "Here's who you are and how that made me do what I did. Because I know you're harsh and you're exacting. You can be a tough master. That drove me out of fear to hide my treasure in a hole. It's because of you that I did this. I could have done more, but if you were different, maybe I would have done something differently. It's not me, it's you." It was his perception of his master, the way he viewed him, that drove him to act the way he acted, to make the choices that he did. And what's remarkable about this is our first time. If you're reading this story, it's kind of surprising that this is his impression of the master. You don't get this idea about who the master is anywhere else in the story. In fact, he seems like a pretty cool dude. First couple of encounters, he's very excited to see that his servants have gone out and taken a risk. I mean, for one, he entrusts a whole lot of money to these guys. It's a lot of money. And then they go out, they take a risk and invest. One guy gets a lot back. One guy gets, again, double back. Not the same as the first, but there's no question about that. There's just, cool, that's awesome. You get the sense that there's a lot of trust, that there's safety to take risks, that this is a really great relationship. Until you get to the third guy. And you're like, where's all of this harsh master? Where's all of this fear and anxiety around the expectation coming from? And we don't get that in the story. All that we get is that this third guy had a drastically different understanding of the character of the master than any of the other servants. And that's what determined what he did. That determined all of the choices that he made. What Jesus is telling us in this story, I think, is that how you view God matters. What you think about God matters. It really, really matters. And not just in some kind of disconnected spiritual sense, but in everyday, how I choose to live ways. This is kind of a sobering thought because most of us don't have really positive views of God. There's a book called The God-Shaped Brain, written by a psychologist named Timothy Jennings. And he cites a 2006 Baylor University survey that they did nationally to evaluate how people viewed God. And in this survey, they found that 23% of those they asked viewed God as benevolent or loving, 23%, while 32% saw God as authoritarian. 16% saw God as critical, 24% as distant. And if you're doing the math and you're going, wait, there's still that 5% considered themselves atheists, so they didn't really. But 23% as benevolent and loving. That means 72% viewed God as authoritarian, as distant, as critical. That was their primary perception of who God is and what God is like. And what do you think that view does to a person? To how they act? How they engage with the world? I was thinking about this with teachers, right? Because for most of us, we have the common shared experience of having a teacher as an authoritarian figure early in lives as we're kind of shaping our view of the world. And how does that engagement kind of work out? And I was thinking about one of my daughter's teachers. I have a daughter, and when she was younger, she had this one particular teacher who, from everything I could tell, was a very, kind person, very nice person. But my daughter was really kind of, she was stressed out about this class. She was anxious, particularly when she had to go in late and miss the class. There were a couple of times, you know, we'd have a doctor's appointment or there'd be something that would cause her to go in late, and she'd come in with a note. It's a legitimate excuse, but she'd be noticeably anxious. We're like, why are you worried? Like, here's the note. I'll send the teacher an email. She said, well, every time I go in the class, when I'm late, she looks at me. I'm like, okay. But no. She looks at me like, you're late. And she's not happy. Now, I have no idea what that look was. It may have just been this woman's regular expression. But my daughter interpreted it as disappointment, anger, frustration with her. And so it created this sense of anxiety. It didn't matter what was true. What mattered was that her experience of this teacher, her perspective on what this teacher was doing when she was looking at her, was all about her being critical or disappointed, angry. And so it created anxiety in her, stress. Whether it was true or not, it didn't matter. It really impacted her. And how do you think these views of God being distant or critical or authoritarian impact us, impact those who hold those views?
Whenever we live with a disoriented or a disordered view of who God is, it has an impact on what we do, but also in who we're becoming. Not just kind of the external action, so that's clear. The choices that we make, much like my daughter, when we view God as angry or distant or critical, they impact the choices we make, how we live our lives, what our expectations are. But it's not just the external things. It's also how we're doing internally. Much like my daughter, who experienced stress that wasn't just about, you know, it affected how she engaged with her teacher. It affected how she thought about going to school, whether she wanted to go to school. But it also caused, you know how anxiety feels. You know how fear feels. This is what was going on inside of her. And if we're constantly living with a disordered view of God, a view that expects that God is critical or authoritarian or distant, it doesn't only affect what we do, it affects who we are and what's happening internally. Again, Jennings, in his book, notes this. He says, "When we worship a being who is punitive, authoritarian, critical, or distant, fear circuits are activated, and if not calmed, will result in chronic inflammation and damage to both brain and body." I mean, in short, it's not good for us to live in a chronic state of anxiety or fear or worry. It's just not good for us biologically, physiologically. But yet many of us live with that sense that God at any moment could choose to just arbitrarily punish us for something we did years ago that we wish we hadn't done, but we know we shouldn't have, and you know, we kind of live with regret. And I can't tell you how many conversations I've had with people who are hand-wringing over something that happened 10, 20, 30 years ago, and wondering if the events that they're encountering right now are a result of that. Could God ever forgive me for the thing that I did? Could God ever love me? Is God happy with me? Are the choices that I'm making God happy? And they live in this constant sense of anxiety or fear. Or, if God is distant, a sense that God just isn't involved. That the difficulties I face, the struggles that I encounter, that they're kind of here or there, neither here nor there to God. It's just what happens. But God is uninvolved. He's distant. And these things, they don't just change the way that we act. They change who we are, how we function internally. They do something to us. And what these false images end up doing is they cause us to live carefully, to live partially, to not fully feel free to live life to the fullest. We bury our treasure in holes because it's not safe. It's not safe to live freely, to take risks. Because what's our master going to do? How's God going to respond? There's a poem by a mystic named Meister Eckhart that I think speaks well to this. He writes, "How long will grown men and women in this world keep drawing in their coloring books an image of God that makes them sad?" I'll read it again. "How long will grown men and women in this world keep drawing in their coloring books an image of God that makes them sad?" And it's that same idea, this idea that many of us live with pictures of God in our head that if we were to run into an individual who parented that way or who interacted with other people that way, we'd say, there's something wrong with that person. Like, that's a problem. But it's how we understand God. It's how we assume that God is. And this is why Jesus is so critical. Because in Jesus, we get the clear image of who God is and what God is like. Jesus reveals God to us in a way that is unfiltered, that isn't kind of marred by our own misperceptions or our own self-projections. Jesus shows us who God is and what God is like. In John chapter 14, verse 9, Jesus says, "Anyone who has seen me has seen the Father." That Jesus is what God is like. And so if Jesus is what God is like, then one of the things, or many of the things we learn about God, is that God is one who responds to failure with forgiveness. He surrounds himself with those that most people would toss to the side because they're damaged goods. He rejects pretentious acts of self-righteousness. He's not interested in those of us who would work really hard to look good on the outside while we're a hot mess on the inside. That this is what God is like if Jesus shows us who God is. And if this is what God is like, it changes everything. If God is the one revealed in Jesus who gives himself in love for all of us, it changes everything. Again, in the last quote I want to share from Jennings' book, he talks about how the concept of God, if viewed through the lens of Jesus, impacts us. He says this, "Does it matter which God concept we hold to? Recent brain research by Dr. Newberg at the University of Pennsylvania has documented that all forms of contemplative meditation were associated with positive brain changes. But the greatest improvements occurred when participants meditated specifically on a God of love. Such meditation was associated with growth in the prefrontal cortex, the part of the brain right behind our forehead where we reason, make judgments, and experience God-like love, and subsequent increased capacity for empathy, sympathy, compassion, and altruism. But here's the most astonishing part. Not only does other-centered love increase when we worship a God of love, but sharp thinking and memory improve as well. In other words, worshiping a God of love actually stimulates the brain to heal and grow." So if this is true, then one of the things that we've come to learn is that if we understand God as Jesus reveals him, it does something in us that has a healing property, a transformative property that enables us to live more the kinds of lives we were made for. It grows in us the things that we long for. It makes us people who look more like Jesus. Who we worship matters. What we believe is true about God affects everything, everything that we do, and even who we're becoming. It shapes us. So, two questions to kind of reflect on as we come to a close, and we're going to move into a time of Q&A. So I encourage you, we're going to have somebody, Carmen's going to have a mic, so I'm going to give her this one, and we'll switch back to the lapel. If you have a thought, a question, something that stirred in you, whether it's something I talked about, or maybe it's even something from the story that we didn't get to, that you're like, hey, that thing, kind of stick that in the back of your mind, and when she comes around, stick your hand up, and we'll interact around that a little bit. If you're uncomfortable talking in front of other people, there's also a number on the back of the bulletin you can text, and we'll try to get to some of those questions as well. But a couple of things to reflect on, a couple of questions. And these aren't super deep, but I don't think they're things we think of very often. The first is, what is your picture of God? When you think about God and what God is like, what images come to mind? Maybe they're words or phrases, maybe they're pictures. What is that image, and where did it come from? And then secondly, how might you begin to develop a more Christ-like picture? How might you choose into cultivating a picture of God that reflects the character of Jesus? Most of us have come across our pictures of God accidentally. We've acquired them over time, whether it's through teaching we've gotten from other places, things we've read, or just thoughts that we've had, popular culture. There's a whole lot of different places. Many of us haven't been very intentional in cultivating that picture. I would like to invite you to consider that you have that opportunity, that you get to choose. That I think the point even of Jesus' parable is that the picture that you have of God matters, and you get to choose into that. You're not a passive recipient, but an active part of shaping that picture in your mind. How might you begin to intentionally reframe your picture of Jesus, or your picture of God, so that it reflects the character of Jesus? Now, there are things we can do individually to that end, primarily in spending time in Scripture with other people, holding kind of before us this picture of Jesus. But I also think there's something that we can do together. There are things that we can do together as a church so that collectively and individually we can begin to have a clearer, more accurate picture of who God is. So we are going to, in a couple of weeks here, we're going to do something together as a church that I'm pretty excited about. Starting the day after Easter. So Easter is April 1st. No kidding. It's actually April Fool's Day, right? So Easter is April 1st. So the day after, we're going to start a 90-day read through the New Testament reading challenge for us as a community. Our desire is to see, our goal is to see 100 people from Koinos commit together to reading through the New Testament. Now, I know for some of you, you're going, that is the opposite of exciting. You're giving me homework? Really? Okay, I get it. But we really think that looking at the New Testament, being people who come to both the biographies of Jesus and the Gospels, but also the whole of the New Testament that is teaching us how to understand who Jesus is critical for us as people to reframe who God is and what that means for us as people who are trying to follow Jesus and live as full human beings in this world and even the world to come. So we think this is really important. We also think there's something powerful about doing it with other people, about doing this in community. And so we'll have more details about this coming out next week and the weeks to come. But we're going to have opportunities for you, optional, you can sign up for this and do it completely individually. But we also want to provide opportunities that as you're reading through, you can get together with other people and talk about what are you learning, what's coming up, what kinds of questions are you asking. Again, we think this can be I'm not overstating this when I say I really think this can be a transformative experience for us to spend that kind of intensive time in Scripture and in community trying to reframe our vision of who God is. And so we're doing, you see this is going to be the cover, I think. We're kind of playing with some things, but something like this of a reading plan that you will get. The painting on here, some of you may recognize, is actually done by our own Brian DeLosier. This was commissioned by Josh Groban. Yes, I'm name dropping. But this is pretty odd. But Brian was really excited to be able to allow us to use this publicizing this so everybody could have access to it. So each person who signs up is going to get a booklet, and there's a reading plan in it that we'll just kind of read through together. So I encourage you to think about that, pray about that, and we'll have more information coming out, but it will actually begin April 2nd. We'll begin it together. But again, more details, more information on that, but I think that can be a really helpful next step for many of us as we do this together. And even if you're someone who's here who's not sure what you think about Jesus, you wouldn't call yourself a Christian, you love the relationships you're building, you're kind of intrigued by the stuff that we're talking about, but you're not quite sure what you think about Jesus, there's no better way to find out what you think about Jesus than read right from the horse's mouth, right? Read the Scriptures for yourself, have some conversations with other people about what you're learning. There, even though I said that, there aren't many horses. I'm sorry, that wasn't even funny. All right, we're going to move on to Q&A now. Before I try and make another lame joke, here we go.
Wrap up our time here by praying for us. The worship team is going to come forward and lead us in a final song. After that, if you're interested, a couple of our deacons will also be kind of back around here, around the corner of the stage. If you would appreciate prayer for any reason, they'll be back there and waiting to pray for you. So feel free to take advantage of that after our final worship song. Father, thank you so much for the chance to be together this morning. Thank you for this story. Thank you for the chance to kind of sit and listen to Jesus' words, to ask questions, and even to see it from different angles. And I pray, Father, that you would help us as we move forward to have our vision corrected. Would you help us, teach us to see you through the character, through the person, through the work, and ultimately through the death and resurrection of Jesus? Would you shape our vision of you in a way that brings life and hope and meaning now and forever? We ask this in the name of Jesus. Amen.